This episode of the React Podcast is brought to you by reacttraining.com. In-person, hands-on training for development teams from React community leaders and experts. Visit reacttraining.com to learn more. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the React Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jackson. My co-host here, Michael Chan.
How's it going?
And today we have a very special guest for y'all, Mr. Harrison Schoaf.
Hey, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sorry, I should have made it more clear that you were supposed to say something at that point, but you did marvelously. Harrison is joining us from the Airbnb offices in San Francisco. He's normally hanging out in New York City, though. He's just out visiting us out here in California for a little bit. And he has been at Airbnb for the last 8 years doing front-end development. The reason we have Harrison on, well, obviously, ton of React going on at Airbnb. The reason we invited Harrison onto the show today is because he is working and has been working for the last couple of years on a library called VX, V as in Victor X, which is a set of D3 bindings essentially for React, but it gives you kind of a React-y, you know, component-based interface for building things on top of D3. So we're very pleased that you could be with us on the show today, Harrison. Harrison, by the way, has kind of an interesting background. Before we get into VX too much, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about his background. Went to the University of Washington and studied electrical engineering.
Yeah.
Now, in my experience, all of the guys who studied EE were like, they were super smart. You know, they had like bright futures ahead of them. How in the world did you get sucked into front-end programming on the web?
Yeah, I know. My parents ask the same question all the time.
We paid all that money for you to make websites? What's wrong with you?
Come on. Yeah, I mean, I got into EE because I just really enjoyed being in the lab, you know, playing with the wires, writing some C, low-level code kind of stuff. And I never actually looked into what do you do after you graduate, like what kind of jobs it would be like. And, you know, once I graduated, I kind of realized what it was like. And you end up doing, you know, 2 years of tests before you start actually building and designing your own stuff. And I kind of realized I wasn't that interested in doing something like that. And I had been doing, I always thought I was going to be a designer, you know, like a web designer, do posters, t-shirts, that kind of stuff. And through that, I picked up JavaScript and jQuery and doing little websites for friends, that kind of thing. And, you know, after I graduated, it was 2010. I was supposed to graduate 2009, but the economy was really bad, so I just stuck it out for another year. And then
I'm just going to hang out here for a little while.
Yeah, it's not bad. You know, keep doing this for a bit until I have to figure something out and make some hard decisions.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I realized, you know, the web was kind of going through the 2.0 phase at that kind of point. So, you know, people were doing a lot of exciting stuff, making some really cool applications on the web, and started looking into it more and learning and just trying to recreate the stuff I saw, you know, on the internet, what people were doing, you know, tabs and photo carousels and all that. And that's how I kind of got into it.
Awesome. Was it mostly jQuery that you were doing back then?
I would say only jQuery, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I at the time I didn't really have a handle on just JavaScript and all of the things it has to offer and all of its lovely bits.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. I used a couple of different ones, but yeah, jQuery was the big kind of granddaddy champion of them all. I always did feel a little bit funny though with the jQuery API though. I felt like, I mean, it was a beautiful API, but there was some times when I would, you know, I would say like $ wrap a DOM node dot photo booth or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like that feels a little weird, but I guess, sure. Yeah, sure. That node is now a photo booth. So how did you, what was your first real like front end gig then? Was it at Airbnb or did you imagine
was.
You kind of?
Yeah, so oh, it was at was Airbnb. It? Yeah.
Wow.
So after I graduated, I picked up a magazine. It was Forbes, or not Forbes, Inc. magazines, like top 30 under 30. And I was like, what are these people doing that I'm not? And I was just kind of flipping through and Airbnb was in there. You know, three founders, two of them being designers. I thought that was really cool and unique. And so it kind of stuck out to me. I didn't really get the idea. Like, I hadn't used the product. I'd, you know, browsed around and thought it was kind of cool. But I was really just thought it was really cool that, you know, two designers were part of the founders. That it was kind of unheard of at the time. And so you looking at my resume, you wouldn't think I was a web front end guy. So I recreated the homepage for Airbnb, just kind of my own design, kind of made it interactive using jQuery and all of that fun stuff, and sent it in, you know, just kind of saying, just give me a shot. I'm happy to do anything. And, you know, I think it was a couple hours later, they called me up for an interview and went through an interview on the phone, which I was not prepared for. And then they called me back 30 minutes later and asked me to fly down to do a real interview. And then the rest is history. Yeah.
Way to get out. Go out and get them, man. You just rewrote the homepage. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. Now, you wrote an article on Medium about your experience, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's called My Airbnb Story.
That's right. That's the one.
Nice. You know, it's so funny. I didn't put that together until like just now, but that's an amazing read, first of all. So we'll link that in the notes. But it was right about that same exact time that I was kind of like doing a similar thing and had a similar experience as you with like some kind of, you know, just doing some like jQuery and like, you know, normal sites. And that article really inspired me to kind of get out of my comfort zone and take risks that I kind of had previously thought maybe were outside of my limits. So thank you for writing that. It's a really, really good read. And I definitely recommend it to anyone who might feel a little bit stuck in their career. So how has that been for you since? Did you feel like, I know a lot of people suffer with from this kind of idea of imposter syndrome, kind of not being fit to do the job that they have.
Yeah.
And you kind of found yourself at a company that was about to take off, and you kind of didn't have that experience, or that's what you kind of allude to. How did that feel in those first couple of years for you?
Well, it was really exciting. I think just given the opportunity, you know, you got to run with it. So I had never worked with like a local DB before. I hadn't worked in Rails, and that's what, you know, they were doing. So that was a big learning curve, and it was a lot of late nights just kind of figuring it out on my own and talking to, you know, I think we were six engineers at the time, just trying to talking to those folks and learning from them as much as I could, and just trying to have impact from day one. You know, maybe I'm not good at everything or not very experienced in a lot of things, but you know, if you give me a task to go make something, I'll go figure out how to do it and try to make it happen as best I can.
You said Rails.
Yeah.
Like, what an amazing piece of software. Like, how many people built businesses that changed the world on top of Rails? And then 10 years later, hired a bunch of other people who are like, oh, this crap sucks. I hate Rails. But like, it allowed people to get started and like build something and launch something. Anyway, this isn't the Rails podcast, but I never realized that Airbnb started on Rails. I was at Twitter for years, and Twitter started on Rails as well.
It's a great way to start, you know, when in the early days, you just got to get up and going and see if you can find people that love your product.
Are there still some remnants of Rails, or how much of it is?
Absolutely. So we're in the process of migrating our monolith Rails app, you know, out into a service oriented architecture at this moment. And most of the services are written in Java these days, but we do have some other Rails services and, you know, Node as well out there. But we still have a lot of Rails, but it's shifting. It's shifting. I think that's what. It's shifting.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this VX library. Now, I have to tell you, VX is a library that I actually first heard about it from Guillermo Rausch. I was just, you know, hanging out on the Twitters one day, and Guillermo posted. He's like, "Check this thing out. VX is awesome." And I went in there, it's not the first sort of bindings library for D3 that I had ever seen. But I really liked a couple of things about it. I really, really liked the approach that you were taking. One of the things that you say on the VX homepage, which is actually hosted on Now. So maybe that's why Guillermo was tweeting about it. In fact, that's probably why he was. That guy's such a self-promoter.
Yeah.
Just a just always like, okay, anyway, I love that guy. Anyway, oh, you said the goal of VX is to create a library of components you can use to make both your own reusable chart library or your slick custom one-off chart. VX is largely unopinionated and is meant to be built on top of. Keep your bundle sizes down. Only use the packages you need. Or use only the packages you need. I think that's a really cool premise to start with. So it's not a charting library. It's rather it's a library of components that if you wanted to make a charting library, sure, you could do that. Or, you know what, forget making a charting library. You could just make your own custom one-off chart.
That's right.
Could you tell us a little bit about kind of that decision? Had you and why you made that decision? Had you tried, you know, other libraries that didn't work for you, or and you wanted something that was a little more kind of custom and stripped down?
Yeah. So about a year ago, I joined the observability team at Airbnb. So we're building monitoring tools for Airbnb engineers, and a big part of that is visualization work. And I knew kind of going into it, that's what I was going to be focused on largely, building UIs around that. And the first thing I did, you know, now that I'm kind of an older engineer is, or more experienced, I should say, is that I went and studied the landscape. You know, what were we already using? How was it being used? What was the plan going forward? And I kind of discovered kind of surprising results. We had, you know, three or four different charting libraries in different places, internal and on Airbnb.com, and as well as just using plain D3 in some places. And I thought that was really interesting. So I went and sought out, you know, the folks working on this stuff, and I wanted to ask them, you know, why, what was the reason? And it kind of came down to a design decision, right? So they had committed to a charting library, and then eventually they ran into, you know, a guardrail where they couldn't go any further with it to build what they were trying to make. You know, the designer had come up with something really amazing and impressive, and they kind of hit a wall with the charting library. And that's why charting libraries are always great until they're not. And at that moment, you really do want to step back and or step down and go more low level and like something with D3 that D3 provides. But, you know, we have very few expert pro D3 folks within the company, and, you know, folks can go off and learn it, and that's great. But, you know, largely that's just going to take up more time. It's going to slow things down, and slowing things down just kills productivity and creativity. So we really just wanted to make something that was like D3, low level and reusable, and just make it feel at home in any React code base, and make it so that maybe if you're intimidated by D3 or you've never used it before, you're unfamiliar with how it handles the DOM and updates the DOM, maybe, but you know React already and you're used to that, maybe there's something there that you could just make it work and pull it all together with all what you already know. And that was what the goal was, and that's how it started. And you know, since day one, just kind of been working on it in open source because I knew it was going to be used in open source. So it's kind of a forcing function on myself to make sure I wasn't doing anything internal out there. And actually, you know, when I first open sourced it, I was really just kind of hoping someone would tell me, come into the issues and say, like, don't do this, this is a bad idea. Like, I've tried this, don't do it. And that never happened, so I've just kind of kept going ever since.
For anyone who's unfamiliar with D3, obviously it has its own ideas about how to manage the DOM and state. What are the hardest parts of trying to merge those two, or merge D3 and React?
Yeah, I think, so for folks coming from a D3 background, you know, and you're not familiar with React, I think that the bigger curve there is learning React. If you're coming from a React background, D3 in the DOM is probably the biggest hurdle for you in terms of its general update pattern. So it has this idea of you bind data to your DOM element, and then you can say, like, as data enters, you know, render this, or basically map over the data, or when it updates, you know, then do this to that node or update its color, that kind of thing, or when it exits, give it a transition where it fades away, that kind of thing. And so it's you know, really beautiful, and it's fun to use. Like, I've had a blast using D3 just itself for a long time. But, you know, it's a bigger hurdle for a lot of React-focused front-end engineers. And Airbnb's big on React, so it never really kind of made sense to just put D3 code in component did mount, that kind of thing, where you just, you know, hand off the lifecycle to D3. Instead, you know, React's really great at it. We know it and love it, and we're aware of where it's good and where, you know, you can get into some problems. So why not just try to bring those two things together? And so, you know, the big part with D3 is when it came out with V4. So it moved into a modular kind of structure, right? So it's broken out into different packages. And that was a huge thing because they actually made something like VX possible, where you didn't have to include all of D3 in your bundle. You can just use the parts that you needed. And that was a big thing for me to kind of work on top of that. And then it's just focusing on, once it was modular, it was just focusing on the bits that weren't DOM related and pulling that in and making it more familiar to React APIs, which I've gotten used to as I've been building React stuff here at Airbnb.
I noticed that a lot of the examples on the D3 site, you'll just, instead of, for example, just rendering one sort of giant component at the top, you'll render, you know, inside your component, you'll return an SVG element, lowercase SVG. It's not some sort of custom VX SVG. And then you'll just drop your own components in there. So I'm looking at an example right now where you've got like a gradient teal blue component, which is something that VX provides, which is cool. And then you've got a lowercase rect, right? So you can still, you know, drop in your sort of built-in SVG elements. Then you've got one of your own components, a group component. And then a nested group component and a bunch of nested bar components inside the group component. So you're basically, when you're using VX, you're weaving in and out of the built-in SVG components and elements that the DOM provides and that React provides, and, you know, VX's components, which I think is a really, really cool way to do it. It really showcases this whole idea of, you know, being modular and building out the right primitives.
Yeah. So as you're reading through that, did anything kind of surprise you while you were reading through the code, or, you know, look unfamiliar?
I mean, not really. I mean, it's which is, I think, a great, this is one of the things that I've already always liked about, you know, the approach that you're taking with VX, is because I kind of look through the code and I'm like, yeah, this looks like SVG code with a few pieces sort of wrapped up in, you know, a few of these kind of low level pieces, like a bar, for example, yeah. Right? So like a bar, you know, I might have to draw my own rect and everything, but it's interesting because even these VX components take a lot of the props that the built-in SVG components will take. So like a bar component takes a fill prop, which is a, you know, it's a prop that anybody who's ever worked with SVG will be totally familiar with.
I really like the boundaries of VX, and it sounds like Michael does too. I wonder, have you had a lot of pushback on that idea of not making a charting library, but making these kind of low-level components that allow you to compose your own charting library? Like, does that philosophically rub people the wrong way sometimes?
I think it's all about expectations. I think when folks come to VX, you know, they're expecting it to be a charting library, and they can feel like, wait a second, maybe I'm doing more work. You know, I'm not just dropping in data and getting a chart with tooltips and stuff. You know, now I'm kind of wiring things up, and I'm making sure I'm mapping over my data and, you know, returning these bars or rects. And, you know, I think that's kind of where the gap is. Once you, you know, not everyone's going to have the problem where they need to build something that's never been built before. You know, charting libraries, the best charting library in the world is going to be the one that anticipates every need for every chart that ever existed or could exist, right? And that's an impossible task. I'm not sure if anyone's going to be able to do it. I think there are some really notable attempts out there that are great and really useful and, you know, make everyone more productive and efficient. But sometimes you're going to be running into something that, you know, you didn't know you were going to end up needing to make. And how do you answer that question? And that's kind of like what this approach is that, you know, you tell VX what you want to make and off you go.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that approach. I've noticed this a lot in my work too, and working with teams, just realizing that like everyone has this kind of like internal sense of rebellion. And like once something becomes too easy, like we just want to like shake it up, even, you know, for better or for worse. And I've loved this pattern of kind of releasing just the the lower level, like the building blocks, and letting people kind of decide, because it really does allow people to kind of succumb to their own sense of rebellion when it comes knocking.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, a large part about VX too is not being or being unopinionated about how you do state management styling. So, you know, any flavor of CSS and JavaScript, or just regular style sheets and class names, or even animations. So VX is unopinionated about all of that. And that was an actual design choice there. But and that's because why should a library be deciding, you know, how your app functions and what it does, you know, what your conventions are for animations and that kind of thing. There's no reason for me, who's not an animation pro, to be writing my own animation library for VX specifically. I think there are much better people out there doing great work around that stuff. And, you know, since it's just React components, anything that works for a React component is going to work with VX.
So have you been surprised by any of the things that people have built with VX?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had more feedback around what people were building and knowing what it was. There's been some cool stuff with Jason Brown. He's been experimenting using VX and React Native and making it work there. I was surprised by that. Like, that was really cool to see that go off and happen. I knew it was possible. I'm just not a pro at that kind of stuff, so I'm not going to be able to figure it out. Let's see. I think when I search GitHub, you know, look for @VX/shape, let's say, just the string, and try to see where people are importing it and what they're doing, I see a lot of Bitcoin charts. I would love to know how people are using it more. I know, you know, internally for us it's been valuable because we built on top of it our own internal charting library. It's called Data UI. It's actually open source as well by Chris Williams. You know, he's a big D3 guy, and he figured out how to make, you know, our charts at Airbnb be themable and consistent across everywhere, and, you know, did a great job of making these beautiful charts with that. And that's open source. And then what we do is we pull in those open source charting library components, and then we theme them within our own internal, you know, kind of bootstrap thing. Where it applies the theme. And then that's how we kind of get our own internal custom charts, but also have reusable charting library components that we can use in our open source projects like Superset, which is a big one by Airbnb.
So could you tell us a little bit about kind of the future of the project? It sounds like you've hit on a good level of sort of primitives for VX. People are building, you know, people like Chris Williams are able to build data UI, things like that on top of it. Is there anything that you kind of, you know, looking back, you're like, oh, you know, maybe I made a mistake there. Maybe I should have done that differently. You know, maybe something that you want to correct, or even just some, you know, extra sort of major feature that you want to add in the future, or do you feel like it's kind of complete at this point?
not complete yet. So if you check out the GitHub README right now, and I get a lot of questions about this. It says it's still in beta, and I'll explain that a bit. But you know, the main thing here is it's not V1 yet. Like I'm just incrementing. What is it? The minor? No, not minor.
Minor.
The patch. The patch. Right.
Oh,
now.
There you go. Yeah.
So I'm only incrementing patches right now, and that was a conscious design choice as well. I didn't want to hit V1 until I had all of the D3 interactions or data visualization interactions. So, you know, cool. Imagine like a brush component, so you can select data and zoom in and, you know, move around, as well as a zoom, pan zoom. That's a big one. I do have a drag interaction component out there, and it's working well for me. You know, the thing is, even though VX, the library itself, might not have the brush component or these kind of things, you can go and, you know, you're still able to build your own on top of VX and use it within your component.
For sure.
So it shouldn't stop you from investigating into it. And I do have plans on supporting it. You know, the problem is I've rewritten it probably 5 or 6 times from scratch, and it's you know, hats off to Mike Bostock. That's a hard one to get right. And, he did a great job with D3 brush. So making it work up to there. I think, let's see, going to the other question about design decisions that I made that I might not make right now. So getting to the V1 is going to be to finish the interactions. But I think the other piece too I'm going back and forth on is I made a design decision to make it feel more like D3 in the sense where you get the data in your, let's say if you're giving an attribute to a bar and you're saying, you know, you're mapping over a series, an array, and you're going to be returning bar components. But you want to change the fill based on the name of that item in the array or something like that, or a stack bar. Mm-hmm. I pass in the data back if you give it a function on fill. And there's kind of a song and dance around that to turn them into functions and bind, pass in the extra argument. And I think that was kind of a, it works, and I think it's okay, but I think it confuses a lot of people coming from React that suddenly their functions are getting called if they're just doing event, whatever in their function. It's now a function that returns a function. And I think people get caught up on that, and that's something where I think I could remove it, because you don't even need it. If you're mapping over data, you already know the data, and you could just do a, ternary kind of thing and just return a different color or something like that. So
yeah, just plug in whatever fill you need, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I think I'll probably be changing that before V1 or keep it around. I'm not sure yet.
A lot of what you're talking about here, honestly, with the VX library is reminding me of conversations that we've had in the React Router repo for a long time now, just about hitting on the right primitives and providing people with the tools that they need to build their own things, like one of my goals for a long time has been to build like a master detail controller sort of view thing for, a mobile device. If you're using React Router on React Native, for example, or even just in a web app on a mobile device, it'd be nice if something like that came up sort of out of the box, a tab controller thing where you could just tap on an item in the master view, and then the detail would sort of slide in, right? And it's that kind of higher level sort of abstraction that you can build on top of, a low level, like as long as you have a system for managing screens and managing routes, and it's not impossible to animate between them, then you could totally build something like that, like on top of them,
Absolutely.
But anyway, it's why I think the design of VX has really resonated a lot with me, because I think you've hit the right primitives.
Well, it's a unique challenge. It's a hard one too, getting the right primitives and staying unopinionated. Yeah. Oftentimes it gets really easy if you get opinionated about things. Like you can make assumptions that you normally wouldn't make if you're not making primitives. So that's the hard part there.
Well, and I've thought for a while now that if you really boiled it down, there are probably 4 or 5, not very many more kind of basic kinds of apps that you would build for, I mean, obviously ignoring custom apps because you can do anything you want, obviously.
Right.
But, out of the box kind of controllers that UIKit gives you on iOS or whatever people are using on Android. I've never done a native app on Android, so I don't know. But there aren't very many of them, right? You've got a master detail view, you've got a modal, you've got a pull to refresh that everybody uses. There are a couple of things that if you just sort of had kind of out of the box that everybody would be able to use. Anyway, I'm talking about my own thing now. I'm not talking about VX anymore. Sorry.
That's great.
that's where my brain goes. Well, okay. So let me ask you one more question before we wrap this up. And by the way, thank you for coming on to the podcast. We've had an awesome time talking with you about VX. I'm really looking forward to using it. I hope that people who, haven't heard about it or whatever before, hopefully got some exposure to it and are able to kind of take a look at it. Do you have a lot of, you said you're not getting a lot of feedback now. So if you're out there and people want to give some feedback, I'm sure Harrison would really appreciate it. So go ahead and check out the, go to the repo. It's all open source. You can go check it out, file some issues, get in some discussions.
Also, it has just the best icon that I've ever, or the best graphic
the tiger?
That I've ever seen on an open source project. That tiger is so fire.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah,
I
that
agree.
Was fun to draw. I did that before I even started writing the code. I had to know what it was going to look like in the end.
I think you prioritized correctly because it looks so good.
Guys, before I write any code, I need the icon.
And the name. I needed a name and a logo, and then I can figure it out from there.
I got it.
It. Honestly, those are the most important parts. Let's be real honest. Frank here.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So can you tell us, Harrison, what in the React community are you excited about right now? What projects have kind of caught your eye? What people are doing interesting work? You know, maybe what people would you like to see here on the podcast?
I got to say, I'm really excited about Reason ML. I know it's really early and, you know, we're not using it anywhere at Airbnb, but I think it's just really exciting, the things it can do with Reason React and the way it's approaching things. I think it's really cool. Totally. As well as if you haven't seen React Sketch App by John Gold at Airbnb, he's doing some cool stuff where you can render your components in Sketch, or go from Sketch to, render your React code into Sketch, which is kind of cool for building out style guides within, you know, your favorite Sketch App kind of thing, which is cool. And then the other project, I think, you know, the hardest component I think that I've had to remake or use someone else's since the beginning of time, it feels like, is a date picker. Well, my favorite React date picker is by Maya W. here at Airbnb. And it's open source at Airbnb React-Dates, and it's the one we use, you know, everywhere. And it's so much fun to use. Like, nice. You know, hats off to Maya. She did a great job.
I imagine that's something you would have to get right at Airbnb.
Yeah. That one, it was a big one, and it was important to get right, you know, making an internet work everywhere for every country, different time zones, and, you know, supporting all the different kind of date picker UI patterns that you find in travel websites. So
for those people who might be thinking right now that they're just going to roll their own, like, are there specific challenges that you could dissuade them with right now and just be like, for this reason alone, use React Dates?
You're going to get some interesting bugs, and I'm pretty sure you're not going to be testing it everywhere. I would recommend against it, you know, either find one that works for your use case, or I would take a long pause before you build your own date picker. It's a hard one.
How long did it take your team to get that right?
A couple iterations. We had we were using a jQuery date picker one in the very early days for a while, and then we ended up realizing it wasn't working for every use case we needed. So then we made it was called a faux query date picker. And that one worked for a while until it didn't. And then we realized that we couldn't be just doing, you know, jQuery date picker within our React components anymore if we're going to be going all in on React. And then Maya picked it up and just kind of ran with it and made it all happen.
Well, cool. You've given us some great ideas. I definitely want to get Maya on here to talk about that. And we should probably get somebody on here to talk about Reason too. I know quite a few people who are working with it. We could get Chang Lu or Jared Forsyth or somebody on here. That'd be awesome. Well, Harrison Schoaf, thank you so much for joining us today here on the React Podcast. And thank you for listening to the podcast wherever you are. We will be back with another episode next week. And thanks again for listening.